Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis and Blake Murphy. And we're actually less than 12 hours away from the start of World Cup play tomorrow, because we got Morocco, we got Croatia opening up Canada's group with their game, and then Canada against Belgium in the afternoon window. This soccer report is brought to you by CertainTeed, the pro's choice for roofing, siding, drywall, insulation, and ceiling systems. CertainTeed Pro all the way. And for some more insight into tomorrow's game, we go to Qatar, talk to Peter Galindo, Sportsnet soccer writer. And Peter, thanks for doing this. You're the first guest we've had from Qatar. What's it actually been like covering this thing?
You know, I feel like I've almost been in my own bubble a little bit, but based on what I have seen over the first couple of days I have been here, it's certainly been very much dominated by, I think, off-the-pitch issues rather than on-the-pitch issues. I think it's starting to deviate away from that as we start to get some surprise results like Saudi Arabia beating Argentina and the like. So, you know, maybe it's kind of moving away, but it seems like every single day there's like another issue to contend with. And that almost makes it a very conflicting event to cover, because obviously most of us are here to cover what happens on the pitch, but there is just no ignoring all the other factors that have gone into this World Cup from the moment Qatar was awarded the hosting rights in 2010 all the way up to now.
No doubt. And we've talked about those issues extensively. We're not going to stop talking about those issues. But yeah, we do have a Canadian team in the World Cup for the first time in 36 years about to open up its tournament tomorrow against Belgium. And we got a piece of good news today. Maybe not unexpected. John Herdman saying that Alphonso Davies, Stephen Eustachio, and Emilian Borjan are all good to go for that match. I guess I'll pose it to you. Was there ever any doubt that all three of those guys were going to be good to go for this opening match?
Knowing John Herdman, I think the way that a lot of us who cover him do, the moment he had said what he said, I believe that would have been on Saturday, it really just completely smelled like mind games to me. And then we ended up seeing Alphonso Davies, Stephen Eustachio, especially train in full on the Sunday. And then that was when we all thought, okay, so clearly this is all kind of a smoke and mirrors attempt, which, you know what, credit John Herdman for trying to throw a wrench into Belgium's plans, because, you know, sometimes it is a bit of a mental game, and he probably got them on their toes a little bit, of course, until us, and I use this term very loosely, but us snakes in the media end up weeding out the issue. And then we end up finding out that obviously Davies is good to go, and Herdman then says, well, there was never really any doubt that he was going to start. And we were like, okay, John, we see you. But that's certainly good news for a team that is going to need players like Eustachio and Davies to be at their best, because I have long said if Canada wants to raise their floor, Stephen Eustachio is the guy, but if they want to raise their ceiling, especially against teams like Belgium, then they need Alphonso Davies on the pitch and to be 100%, and luckily from a Canadian perspective, that's exactly what it looks like.
It's particularly interesting. Obviously, it's the opening game. It's the first look we're going to go get at them. But a Belgium team that can attack as fiercely as Canada can. And I'd imagine the game plan would have looked significantly different without Alphonso Davies. If you are Canada heading into this matchup with Belgium, are you kind of going with the mentality of the enterprising style you played all through qualification is what got you there and you should stick to that? Or are you thinking more tactically and more, hey, we got to match up to Belgium, they're the favorite, we got to take advantage of what they give us, and then Croatia, you know, maybe the game plan's a little better, a little different the next time out? Where do you stand on, you know, being who you are versus trying to optimize every little shred a European power will give you?
I feel like it's a situation where I almost feel like Belgium at times is just going to see the initiative, because they're going to be so aware that Canada is a threat in transition. In fact, Roberto Martinez said it today, Jan Vertonghen, one of their defenders, said it today, that they do have to respect Canada and their pace and the threat they pose in transition. So I feel like even if Canada didn't want to, they're going to have to play with the ball a little bit. But luckily for them, I don't think they're going to deviate too much from what we've seen up to this point. And it's almost unfathomable to think that they're probably going to go out there against Belgium and try to play their style. But listen, this is this new Canada that we've all seen. They have confidence. They have this this humbleness when they need it, but then when they really want to, especially on the pitch, they can just kind of turn into, and I use this term very, glowingly, but cocky on the pitch. And I think we're going to see that in spades. Now, no doubt about it, there are going to be certain areas of the game where it's certainly going to come down to one or two areas. I would say still the transition game, because as we saw against Japan, I think Canada actually coped with the pace of play very well, keep in mind, without Davies and Eustachio. So to me, at least based on what I saw, they can probably hang with teams who play a fast-paced, fluid style. The question is, when the stakes get raised on the World Cup stage, is the opponent still going to give them that opportunity? And I guess we'll find out tomorrow.
The way I've seen them play during qualifying, I think I would be shocked if John Herdman ever played a cautious style here, Peter. Like, I can't anticipate this team ever not going for the full 3 points.
No, exactly. And that's kind of what John kind of alluded to in the press conference, was that they're, you know, trying to approach all three games to try and win them. And you know what? Kudos to him, because that's exactly what you kind of have to do. You're at a World Cup for the first time in 36 years on the men's side. Yes, you're going up against three quality opponents, but what's the point of going if you're not going to at least try, right? So honestly, I'm all for that. And sure, they might not win a game, but at the very least, I think they're going to be competitive here. And that is more than I think any Canadian fan could have asked for even, you know, 6-8 months ago, to be fair.
So Canada, during the qualification process, we saw them use a 3-5-2 occasionally, but it was mostly the 4-4-2 that we got familiar with. Is that what you'd expect now that we know that Eustachio and Davies are going to be in there? Are you expecting a 4-4-2 tomorrow? And you know, are you expecting any surprises in the starting 11 off of, you know, what I think people who have watched about the qualifier may be expecting?
I don't think there will be too many surprises. In fact, I think it's pretty much going to be the same 11 we saw against Japan. Just swap out Piet for Eustachio. Probably take out Kyle Larin for Alfonso Davies. I know that sounds crazy to take out Canada's all-time leading goal scorer on the men's side. However, he isn't playing a lot for Club Rouge these days. And more than any other player that I can think of, Kyle Larin really suffers, I think, from inconsistent minutes when it comes to his technique. His touch is a little heavier. He's a bit more indecisive in those crucial moments, especially in the box. And I don't think you can afford to have any of your forwards, really any of your players in general, to have that hesitancy about them. So I think Davies will come in for Larin, and then it's going to be the exact same 11 we saw against Japan. So Borjan in goal. You're going to have a back three in possession of Johnston, Vittoria, Miller, with Atiba Hutchinson and Stefan Eustachio just in front of that defense in a double pivot. Sam Adekubi, Tejon Buchanan as the wingbacks, Junior Hoylett just in front of that double pivot. And then you're going to have Davies and David up front, with Hutchinson at times, I think, dropping in to form, you know, at times a back three to allow Johnston to get forward, similar to what we see with CF Montreal. So I think it's going to be a very fluid system that we see, but composed of those 11 players.
So we've been talking about Canada's win over Japan in their final pre-tournament matchup, and it was a late goal that got them that victory. Belgium, on that same day on Friday, lost to Egypt. So what does that mean, Peter? Is Belgium not coming in here as their strongest side?
Well, let me tell you, the Belgian press were none too pleased at Roberto Martinez when he came into the press conference. They kind of grilled him a little bit about that result, and no doubt about it, they were lamenting that result. But I think what it did tell us is that this Belgian defense is very slow, and as we have seen, Canada's forwards are very, very fast. And Egypt were able to capitalize on Belgium at times having a high line whenever they were in possession. And then they just hit quick vertical balls in behind. Trezeguet for Egypt went in behind and was able to finish very, very composed. So I think if Canada can replicate that, and there's no reason why they can't, then I think they're going to have a few opportunities here. But as always, it's going to come down to just, are they going to be clinical in those moments? Are they going to be lethal in those moments? That is going to make the difference.
Well, and not that the one thing should have an impact on another, but it is interesting that we get one of the biggest shocks in World Cup history a day before Canada's matching up against the second-ranked FIFA nation in their return to the World Cup after 36 years, Saudi Arabia knocking off Argentina. Does that impact, like, at least the feeling going into this match? Was that something that the Canadian players were talking about today?
Yeah, they were kind of coming into it. Well, you know, if there's any time to preach this this mentality, it's, you know, we've really got nothing to lose, so we're going to enjoy it, and we're just going to go out there and essentially play without fear. And I think what it also taught us, that Saudi Arabia result, if you look at that Saudi Arabian squad, the majority of it is made up of one club from Saudi Arabia, Al Hilal, who are the champions. And the Saudi Arabian League actually paused in about mid-October to the third week of October, and they have had a camp for the last month leading into this tournament with tons and tons of friendlies. So you could see that they were all very, it was a very organized unit out there. And I think Canada, the one thing that I think they have going for them, and Roberto Martinez himself actually mentioned this in his presser, was that it's a team, Canada, that doesn't play like a national team. They play very much like a club, and they have the atmosphere of a club. And I think that's going to behoove them here, because just like every other European team and some of the bigger South American nations, this Belgian squad did not get together until about a week ago. And I think you kind of saw that in that Egypt result. They were a little bit disjointed. That's not to say that the Egypt result means nothing, because there are certainly things that Canada can take from that and say, you know what, we can replicate that. But I think certainly in the early goings of this tournament, you're going to see a few of those teams slip up, and perhaps Belgium could be one of them.
And if you're looking at, well, Canada is making changes from their last friendly or from their qualifiers, it's two guys you're pretty confident with stepping in. Eustachio, who has a lot of equity built with this group, and Alphonso Davies, who might be the best player in CONCACAF. You'll just make whatever work with him. So that's the Belgium-Egypt side. I'm curious if you have taken anything from Mexico and the United States drawing Poland and Wales respectively. There was some question about, you know, Canada's only played CONCACAF teams, and CONCACAF teams haven't generally done excellently in recent World Cups. So how would Canada's success translate against European teams? We'll see on Wednesday for sure. But have you seen anything from those other CONCACAF games that gives you confidence or pause in what Canada did to get here?
I think if there's anything, it's that much like Mexico, much like the U.S., all three of those teams, maybe more so in the case of the U.S. and Canada, but they all have players who are now playing at the absolute highest level in high-pressure environments every single week, and you're seeing the difference it makes when they go out onto the pitch in front of millions of people watching and thousands of people in the stadium. So to me, you know, regardless of whether you're from Canada or you're from the U.S. or you're from Belgium or you're from Wales and what have you, all these players are going to be used to that. And I think that, honestly, that this is what's kind of unfathomable to think about with this Canadian squad, is that there are players here who are legitimately not frightened by this moment and by this stage. They actually embrace it and relish it and cherish it.
So Group F play actually gets underway at 5 o'clock in the morning. If people are you know, up to setting their alarms and scouting the competition, Morocco and Croatia open up the slate of games on Wednesday. What is, because beating Belgium or even getting a result against Belgium, that would be ideal. It's not expected, but even if that doesn't happen, there is still a path out of this group. What is the most likely path for Canada to get out of Group F?
Well, see, this is why I'm interested to go and watch that Morocco-Croatia game, which I am going to do tomorrow, because I feel like all four of these teams are so balanced. In fact, Morocco almost plays very similarly to Canada in that they have a lot of pace on the wings. They have a youthful squad. And Croatia, I feel a lot of people, especially in Canada, are sleeping on this Croatian team because the way they play is so quick and fluid. They're going to really give every team in this group a challenge. In fact, I actually back them to win the group. So I actually look at that Belgium game as possibly being the one out of Canada's first two games where they could potentially get a surprise result here. And if they do, listen, you just have to get one win from your last two games. I know it's easier said than done, but that could be how it lines up. And You know, quite frankly, I've been saying it for the last few weeks. I think Canada, at the very least, is going to do what I think Iran did 4 years ago in that Spain and Portugal group, where they get a point off of one of the big boys, they win their quote-unquote winnable game, and give themselves a shot to get to the next round. Unfortunately for Iran, 4 years ago, it didn't happen. Maybe that could be the case here for Canada, just based on what happens and what's going to be a very competitive and balanced Group F.
Yeah, it would be pretty awesome to see Canada with a chance to get out of the group going into that final match against Morocco. Peter, thanks for doing this, and enjoy Qatar.
I will. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
There is Peter Galindo, Sportsnet soccer writer in Qatar, getting us set for Canada-Belgium tomorrow. And that's an interesting component to this, because you look at the FIFA world rankings and you see number two, and that seems like very good, because it is. But the FIFA world rankings aren't the be-all end-all, and the reason I know is because Canada shouldn't be like 20 slots behind the U.S. and Mexico, right? Like, we saw them play those teams pretty well. In fact, finished at the top of the CONCACAF standings throughout World Cup qualifying, so the argument should be made that they're actually superior to those two nations. But yeah, it's accumulation of ranking points throughout multiple weeks. I get that, and maybe, you know, in 4 years, although it won't matter anyways because they'll be a host nation and probably put into one of the host nation pots. But yeah, it's not everything. But I think most people view this first match tomorrow as, yeah, you're probably going to lose. Like, a result would be unbelievable. The real matches that you got to get results against if you really do want to convince yourself that Canada has a chance to get out of this group is Croatia and certainly Morocco. And Morocco, I would say, yes, clearly the third best team, that their FIFA rankings are actually indicative of the challenge that they present to Canada. But it's interesting to hear Peter talk about, yeah, like, Croatia is probably a tougher test, especially stylistically, against Canada, that if there's a surprise result that Canada is going to get against a pretty good nation, it might actually come tomorrow against Belgium.
It might. And, you know, the ranking argument is an interesting one, because the FIFA ranking process is, as everyone knows, a little convoluted and not quite.
And you're going to explain it right now.
No, I'm not, because, like, you know, no disrespect to ELO, our chess buddy who created the ELO rating system, and that's kind of what it's based on. But yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, but if anybody was going to get a handle on it, it would be you, Blake.
Well, I have a handle on it, just not enough to explain it on the radio, because I don't think people will care. Basically,
yeah, that's
all you
point.
Need to know is that the ranking system is maybe not flawed, but it lags a little bit, maybe reputation.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like defensive player of the year. Like, OG Anunoby's been the defensive player of the year for a couple years now, but it's only now that the ratings and everything are catching up. No, I do think it's an interesting element of, you know, we talked to James Sharman the other day about it too, of, you know, would you prefer to have this matchup early? Like, Belgium's maybe the best team reputationally or overall on paper, and, you know, kind of iron sharpens iron. Now, you could, if you believe Croatia is a tougher matchup for Canada, you can almost get the best of both worlds, where you don't ease into it. You do get a tough matchup right away, but it better prepares you. Now, Croatia and Belgium, as I understand it, pretty different in terms of their strengths and the style they'll play against Canada. The big issue with Croatia being their elite midfield, and they're going to control the possession game in a way that, sure, Canada can still be on the counterattack, but those opportunities are going to be a little less frequent. Yeah, I don't know. I think all of this talk and everything you could say about all three of the matchups, all this is just highlighting is how awesome and intense this whole thing is, where every one of these games, like, tomorrow is going to feel huge because it's the first World Cup game in forever, and maybe Belgium's your best, a better chance to beat a team higher seeded than you than Croatia is. And then you win the Belgium game, and suddenly Croatia's the most important game because you could clinch getting through.
Yeah.
In certain scenarios, or you lose to Belgium and then suddenly Croatia, you have to get a point if you have any hope. Like, it's a, you might only get three games. Everything is huge.
All right.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
That's my take on the FIFA rankings, is that whatever goes into it, who, I don't know, but like, it makes every game in the World Cup every 4 years just massive.
Yeah. It's huge. It's awesome. It kind of, okay, where my brain goes is 2019. And I don't know if you remember, what were the betting odds on the Raptors beating the Warriors in that finals with Kevin Durant's uncertainty? Do you remember? Like, you can look it up, and we can all look it up. But do you remember, like, it certainly wasn't plus 500, or was it? Was it, like, close to? It was like,
because we didn't know about Kevin Durant's status. So after game one...
No, I'm
trying to search my old tweets to find out what the actual line was.
Because usually
I tweet that out.
In regards to game one, I remember going into that finals and everything. Okay, it wasn't all gravy. Certainly, yeah, you had to at least get to an East final, and the Kawhi rim bounce against the Sixers was super important, because not getting to at least an East final would have been an abject disaster with Kawhi Leonard. It was gravy to a degree when you got there against the Bucks. But then finals against this historically great Golden State Warriors team, in which you're a heavy underdog, even with the greatest player in the postseason. Yeah, that was, hey, make it interesting. I remember going into that series, though, thinking, man, if they could find a way to win game one, right? Like, if they could make this interesting and people could, like, kind of twist their brain into, like, a fantasy land of somehow the Toronto Raptors becoming NBA champions in 2019 against Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. Turns out not Klay Thompson. Turns out not Kevin Durant. But that would be amazing if you could just dream on that. Like, extend the dream a couple more days, and then, of course, they win game two. And they end up winning the series in six games. Yeah, it all played out perfectly. But that's kind of the mentality I have in regards to Canada going into this World Cup, that they're massive underdogs, not just against Belgium, but to get out of the group, and they should be. And we don't know anything about them. But that if they could just, like, get a result, or maybe it's not even a result. Maybe it's, like, taking a lead against Belgium and playing them closer than anyone anticipated.
Like, scoring a goal in the World Cup is a big deal for a lot of nations at a certain stage in their program development.
Is my comparable making sense to you?
Yeah, it is. It's making sense. It's a little hard just, like, comparing the odds, because a draw can happen, and that couldn't happen. So the Raptors were plus 250.
To win that series.
To win that series at the start of the series. And again, Kevin Durant, we thought at that point he was coming back after game three. That was the, like, rumblings out of San Fran was, hey, KD for game three, maybe game four.
Yeah.
And that's
pretty lopsided for a seven-game series where both teams have had to get through three rounds of the postseason. They were heavy underdogs.
It's about a 30-70 projection for the Raptors in that case.
So the
odds would say at that point the Raptors had about a 30% chance of winning that series. Now, for Canada to just win tomorrow, the odds are longer than that. It projects about a 15% probability, but you combine that with the probability of a draw, and you're looking at, okay, Canada has a better chance based strictly on the odds maker lines. The market sees Canada having a better chance of getting at least 1 point tomorrow than it did of the Raptors winning the championship.
Wow. There we go. And you did that
on the fly. Yeah, I gotcha.
The top of your head on the fly.
Well, I got my little probability converter to change the lines into probabilities, because it's easier to talk in probabilities than, you know, minus 310 or plus 250 or whatever. It's easier to just say, well, it's a 30-70, and, you know, tomorrow it's closer to like a 38% chance that Canada gets a point.
Okay, and just in my ear, producer Mike Gentile said Canada's plus 300 to get out of the group. So, yeah, like, we're talking pretty similar to the odds of the Raptors winning the 2019 NBA title.
Yeah, plus 300 is a nice, easy one. That's 25%. That's
okay, well done.
I don't need my little calculator for that one.
It's a big calculator. It's your computer. Don't discount the size of your calculator. All right, when we come back, lots to get to, including Alek Manoah continuing his beef with Gerrit Cole. Also, some ESPN experts predicted where Brandon Nimmo will land. Got a little bit more on Rasmus Sandin as well as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. I think this will generally be the format of this final segment. We're just trying to figure out what the show sounds like and what we're most comfortable doing. But yeah, I think last segment, bunch of different things that we can get to.
Actually, I'm out of here. I'm going to go do TV.
Okay.
Abandon you again.
No, that's generally, well, not, but occasionally that will be the way the last segment of this program goes.
I don't have one until next Friday.
Great.
You're in the clear.
All right.
Stuck Friday. With me.
Unbelievable. This is also a segment of the program where, you know, maybe ideas pop into our head after talking to guests or having conversations that we'll put them in this bucket right here after 6:30. And talking to Frank Saravelli and him bringing up the Rasmus Sandin holdout thing, I was reminded of something that I thought at the time. So Rasmus Sandin held out, and then the Leafs did start suffering a bunch of injuries on the blue line at the time that he decided to return to the team. And I remember thinking at the time, like, wait, what the hell was the holdout? Like, that's the dream scenario just presented itself, and you're saying no more holdout. We're gonna play for the money that you offered us out of the gate. The holdout was baffling at that time, but Frank's 100% right. So even with the injuries suffered in the preseason, hold on one second.
Don't wave me off.
Hold on one second. Let me just get this out. Even with the injuries they suffered in the preseason, it wasn't, you know, Jake Muzzin wasn't injured. Morgan Riley wasn't injured. TJ Brody wasn't injured. It was not a dire situation even to have Rasmus. You wanted him, and he got an opportunity out of the gate. And Jake Muzzin was dealing with some stuff preseason. But this is the true deal right here. Like, if Rasmus Sandin had been sitting on the sidelines at this point, then you could have really put the Leafs into a tough spot, considering they need a defenseman.
If all those defensemen were healthy and the Leafs were still an elite defensive team as they've profiled that so far, and you get nothing. And that's the risk-reward trade out there. Now, the actual holdout and the way it ended, I think, tells you one of two things, and maybe both. One is they saw the kind of PR side of things not go their way, and that was a way for him to step in and be like, no, the team needed me. Like what's a little bit of money? And that's how they tried to play it. That is how they tried to play it. The other thing, and this is maybe more straightforward, it's a little hard to look at it this way if you're an agent, maybe, but Muzzin's status opened up more playing time. And part of the discussion was, what is Sandin's role? Mm-hmm. Especially if he's going to sign a short deal that has him back in free agency soon. If he is playing a third pair role for the whole year or for the next 2 years, that looks different at $1.4 million in terms of your future earning potential than playing second pair minutes or getting some power play time and stuff. So maybe the Muzzin thing just opened up a very clear path for Sandin to play more of the bet on yourself card.
Or, and I would never advocate for somebody being fired, or you just have a really bad agent, give you bad advice.
Yeah, there was not a market for you, and like... Like, who, this is the thing, the December 1st deadline's so weird, and obviously Nylander kind of, quote-unquote, won his, even though it's not...
It's a great deal.
Yeah. Where is the team? Actually, the team is the Toronto Maple Leafs, but, like, say he had played it out and the Leafs stayed healthy, who is coming at a restricted free agent with an offer sheet right now, right?
Right.
Like, it's a weird leverage play to go into the season, but only part of the season, and I don't know, it's just a...
Yeah, it was a bad idea.
It's a strange thing.
Yeah,
but and it's a bad idea, but like the guy down the bench from him won that thing. Like he did that and it paid off for him.
I guess.
William Nylander, probably more established in what William Nylander was going to be at the time than Rasmus Sandin.
Yeah. And that was the beginning of the cap hell that the Maple Leafs found themselves in. They're now fully entrenched in cap hell. So yes.
The biggest victim of the entire global pandemic,
yes.
The Toronto Maple Leafs and their cap sheet.
100%. All right. As I mentioned, a number of things we want to get to. Let's start with the Alek Manoah and Serge Ibaka's How Hungry Are You show, which you can watch on Sportsnet. You can access on sportsnet.ca. It's fun. Alek Manoah is fun. Serge Ibaka, super fun, as we well know. He was asked a bizarre question, and I wonder why it was a question, but he asked it anyway. Serge Ibaka asked him, who the biggest cheater in baseball history is, and here's what Alek Manoah said.
Who is the worst cheater in baseball story?
In baseball history?
Yeah.
Cheater?
Yeah.
Gerrit Cole.
Gerrit Cole, what he did?
Yeah, he cheated. He used a lot of, like, sticky stuff.
Yeah.
To make his pitches better.
Wow.
And he kind of got caught out on it.
Okay. Yeah.
So this one's for you.
All right.
The reason that the question comes up is there is a segment on that show where Ibaka asks quote unquote spicy questions.
Okay.
And there is this tea sitting in between them. And it's, I guess, a very nasty tea. And if Manoa declines to answer, he has to drink the tea. If he answers, Ibaka has to drink the tea. So you see after that, Ibaka like take a gross sip of this weird tea. And I guess so Manoa had to answer, and if it wasn't satisfactory or it didn't seem truthful.
I mean, he could have answered Shoeless Joe Jackson or Barry
Bonds.
Yeah, that
guy played with no shoes.
he didn't have to say Gerrit Cole. I'm glad he did. Like, I'm glad that this rival, I mean, he had an opportunity after the little bench clearing brouhaha to slough that aside and didn't, and talked about how Gerrit Cole did not come past the Audi sign. Secondarily to that, I feel very confident that Alek Manoah doesn't use the sicky stuff, because I talked to Eno Saris about how the spin rate declined after they started checking and then kind of like crept back up. The guys are maybe finding some other way to use it or something different. And I guess Alek Manoah pretty confident in himself that nobody's going to blow the whistle on him.
Try it. Find out. Alek Manoah has the most like wish you would energy in baseball. Like, him telling Gerrit Cole to go, what was it, the Audi sign?
Yeah.
Was it Audi?
Yeah, it's like maybe next time if he's really interested, he'll come past the Audi sign.
Yeah, try it. Like, Alec, I know that, like, he very much cares about baseball. He wants to win and all that stuff. Sometimes I get the impression that he just wants someone to step to him, too. Like, yes. I know he's a big UFC guy. Talked to Ariel Helwani about their relationship in the past and stuff, and I don't know. If I'm Gerrit Cole, I'm not pushing this any further. I know Gerrit Cole's a tall guy, but he did the like Shawn Michaels Diesel thing where he was jawing at Manoah when Aaron Judge was standing beside him.
That's right.
If Aaron Judge signs elsewhere, yeah. Gerrit Cole's a quiet guy now next time he plays the Jays.
100%. Raptors at the practice today before their game tomorrow against the resurgent Brooklyn Nets.
We'll see. No Yuta Watanabe for them tonight. Oof. They're on the first night of a back-to-back playing against Philly. I don't know. Yeah. I actually think it's just like part of the long con of like Yuta Watanabe never taking up William Liu on his offer to get ramen together. Like now he's injured and I'm not even at the game. Can't do it. But yeah, he's been like one of the success stories of the season. Anyway, that's not where you were going.
No, it's fine. But yeah, if he's in street, like I imagine he's traveling, right?
Yeah.
Won't he be in street clothes? Like it's more likely that he would go out with William Liu.
He has to be doing rehab.
Yeah,
can't
sure.
be adding extra stress to the body like that.
All right, so there's a couple of things.
Yeah,
Scotty Barnes still banged up, missing practice today, like
with a diagnosis now. So we've been asking and thinking ankles, what's going on? Knee sprain kept him out of practice today. He's questionable tomorrow.
That's not great. Because yeah, it's a bummer that the Raptors are so banged up. But the reason, I mean, the biggest reason that they're still intriguing, interesting to watch is the Scotty Barnes sophomore season, and obviously having his best game of the year over the weekend, you would have loved to see a follow-up against a good Brooklyn Nets team, but a very porous defensive team. But yeah, it doesn't look like we're going to get to see that.
No, there were a couple small bits of positive news, though. Pascal Siakam continues to do work on court. They're targeting maybe a return next week.
Okay.
So that's a positive.
When would that be? 4 weeks?
Yeah, I think we're at about 2.5 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, give or take. Which for a growing thing, they're going to be very, very careful with it. But yeah, that's not bad. Like it's enough that there's a light at the end of the tunnel that you're like, okay, if you can take one of Brooklyn or Dallas, then maybe you've survived the Siakam absence at 500, which is really all you can ask for given the extra injuries that were layered on. Delano Banton's questionable tomorrow. He's caught that non-COVID illness everyone else has.
Yeah.
Trenton Boucher back in the mix. Precious Achiuwa behind Pascal Siakam, but at least out of the walking boot.
That's good.
Yeah.
I saw you going at somebody on Twitter for calling it a medical walking boot.
I was just joking around.
I know.
Yeah, it was just very specific. I guess technically
it's just a boot.
Any boot is a walking boot.
That's right. Unless, you don't walk, but yeah.
By the way, one other note on that Nets game tonight. So they're in Philly, right? And everyone's expecting Ben Simmons to to get the heat, and Ben Simmons has laughed at it. Like someone asked, like, has enough time passed where you don't think you'll get it? And he kind of laughed and was like, it's Philadelphia fans. Yeah. Jacques Vaughn, the new head coach of the Nets, was asked about that pregame. And this quote comes from Keith Pompey, our buddy at the Philly Inquirer. And you remember the movie Old School?
Of course.
Jacques Vaughn says, this is a Vince Vaughn earmuffs night tonight.
Yeah, I would say that's a nice one.
Before only Dad speaks that way is the other old school adjacent way you could go with that one.
So before we get off the Raptors, you mentioned Gary Trent Jr. returning to health for the Toronto Raptors. Nick Nurse, an interesting back and forth about Gary Trent Jr. today.
Disappointing. It's disappointing. We'd like to get him a lot more aggressive on defense this year. I would say I don't know what the word is. It's been a little bit of a negative, right? Because he's capable of really getting after the ball and getting his hands on the ball a lot, and that's what we want him to do. You know, we're going to get him his shots and get him his points, but we want him to be a disruptor. He kind of fits us if he does that. And if he doesn't, he doesn't fit us.
That's pretty harsh from Nick Nurse. The end there, if he does that, he fits us, and if he doesn't fit us, is pretty striking. So to contextualize this, Nick Nurse had been asked specifically about Gary Trent Jr.'s deflections per game being down. They are down. It's not the stat. Defensive stats, we don't have a lot. So deflections
is something.
It's one indicator of your activity level, especially in a defense like the Raptors, where they want to lead the league in deflections. They want to lead the league in steals, because that to them is a measure of, well, not only fueling your transition game, but also making an opponent uncomfortable. So Gary Trent's down in that regard. He's down in steals per game, which was the kind of the story of his defensive improvement early last year. His three-point percentage is in the tank too. I think that'll come back no problem. He has too big a sample not to. But even his assists are down, and that was the one area of growth he had last year, where he still wasn't a playmaker, but he's back down to being in the second percentile for assist rate. Like, there's almost nobody who passes less than Gary Trent relative to how often he shoots.
That matches the eye test.
Yeah. And the net effect of all of this, his defense continuing the decline we saw later in the year last year from where it had gotten to, and then some of the offensive progress trailing off, and then the three-point shot just not falling at the rate we'd expect, is that Gary Trent has absolutely sunk all the lineups that he's been in. Like, the Raptors starters, you have been pretty neutral. And actually, when the Raptors have five starters on the floor, they're like 27th in net rating among like all teams when they have five starters out there. You take Gary Trent out of there and you start mixing and matching with different lineup combinations. Even when you lose a Fred or a Pascal or a Scotty Barnes, it's pretty remarkable the on-off lineup stuff with and without Gary Trent right now. And there's, you could take that and you could make an argument that maybe he should, you know, we talked before the season a lot about, is his role maybe more ideal off the bench in the kind of Jamal Crawford, Jordan Clarkson, Tyler Hero mold? Maybe. But the reality is he's not playing well enough right now, period. And Michael Grange has a piece up at sportsnet.ca about just this. The one thing I'll pick at with Michael Grange's piece, and it might just be how he tweeted out, it says, it's no secret that Gary Trent Jr.'s contract year isn't exactly off to a rousing start, and continues from there. You play like this, it might not be a contract year.
Yeah, like, because it's a player option, right?
I think he's going to get his money still, because he's young and he has that scoring pedigree and three-point shooting so important. But yeah, I don't know that he's getting the like $25 million a year he probably thought he was getting before this year, if he continues to play like this.
Well, and secondarily, like, if you are swinging for the fences with a big trade, right? Like, his is the money that you're almost...
It's always been the case.
Right, yeah.
And like, you want to look across the floor at Kevin Durant and what that would have looked like. Salary-wise, you have to add more to it. But, like, Gary Trent's the guy that gets you in that conversation. You want Eric Gordon? Gary Trent's the guy if you don't want to, like, trade four guys for that piece. So he's in a weird spot for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. And that was pretty harsh criticism from his head coach. As mentioned, Raptors and Nets tomorrow. You're right. Yeah. Nets and Sixers tonight, in a very interesting matchup, and one that is highly anticipated. And while Ben Simmons has returned to Philly in a bench role, he's wearing those glasses. Like, man, I remember even like his attire when he was sitting on the bench last time the Nets were in Philly was not something that I would have suggested that he wear, but today he will be in uniform to play against the Sixers for the first time. This is one of the topics I'm most interested about in modern pro sports. It's the balance between humanizing athletes and thinking about them as more than just the name on the back of their sweater and just like fantasy players and them as actual human beings that have lives outside of the lines.
There's the sports betting component too of now in some areas, the aggression with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe tilts upwards.
Yeah. Okay. And the balance between, understanding that these people are human and also the fact that I like my sports to have like a hard edge, especially when one is there naturally. Now, there's obviously a line, right? So when I'm talking about tonight, Ben Simmons is going to be booed vociferously.
Although,
if I can say it
there
correctly.
Is a video of him pregame climbing into the stands to sign autographs for fans.
Okay, well, that's a good proactive move.
Yeah, he's trying to, he knows what he's doing.
He's going to be booed a lot because he left on not great terms and he didn't want to return to that team, despite the fact that I thought the criticism he received at the end of that postseason series where he decided he didn't want to make layups anymore, I thought was, like, considering the circumstances, pretty tame.
Yeah, the basketball criticisms of Ben Simmons have never been unfair. Like, yeah. His inability to develop a three-point shot, we've heard for a fair amount of time, like going back to his college years, that maybe the voices around him or the trainers he worked with in the offseason stuff were not the most productive in terms of Ben Simmons improving as a player and taking any shortcomings or failures on himself to improve. Like, there are different personality types when it comes to that stuff, and Ben Simmons walked in the door as a very good player, so it can be maybe hard to get to the point where you're humbled enough to work on that stuff. Maybe not everyone has the three-point shot in them, but you gotta at least try. Like, Pascal Siakam didn't become a three-point shooter until he had almost literally the worst three-point shooting season in NBA history.
Yeah,
that was part of the process.
Yep.
So I think the basketball criticisms of Ben Simmons have been pretty fair over the years.
I think it's all been fair.
He didn't improve as a player. Basically, I mean, like, small improvements since he was a rookie, but some stuff has, I don't know that the defense is still at all defense level anymore. Right. And, the availability in and out has a chemistry trickle down and a continuity trickle down. Now, the criticisms of him and the mental health side of him needing to be away from the team or be removed from the situation.
We'll never know the reality there. I'll give the benefit of the doubt to the player. I really will.
I will too. And, J.J. Redick spoke about this on his podcast recently. And, one of the important things that I think he said is, he said two things that I took away. And one was that all of us talking about and recognizing the mental health side of things a little more has helped humanize players. And he went back and said that basically he doesn't think people intentionally dehumanize players, but you can start to look at a guy as a line on a box score or a line on a cap sheet. But the other thing that Redick said that I think is really important, and this is a credit to guys like DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love, is that most of the conversation that has resonated with this stuff has been player driven.
Sure.
And that's an important aspect of it.
Yeah, it is. Great. That's awesome. Like, I don't want to ever stop that from happening. Players coming forward, telling their stories, talking about the dark places they've been to, and hopefully that allows them to seek some help, some understanding, and people are understanding of them as humans. But I don't want the Sixers fans necessarily going into this game against their former player and treating him with kid gloves, because that's not the fun sport.
They're not going
to. I know, but the idea that is like that. That someone would ever view the fans, and maybe I'm making a straw man here, because maybe the person I'm talking about doesn't exist, but that anyone would view what's about to happen in Philadelphia as like some moral failing of the fans of the Philadelphia 76ers. That's what pro sports is about, right? Like, as long, there's obviously a clear line here. Like, anything talking about personal.
Sure. This is just common sense in how we talk about mental health in general and how it's so the easiest way, I think, to continue to get the buy-in from like the team and league side that this is an important thing is, you know, treat it like physical health, right? If Ben Simmons got booed and jeered because he missed the game with a sore ankle and like fans made it out to be like, oh, he's ducking the Sixers. Like he's conveniently injured every time he comes. No one would think anything of that.
Right.
Like obviously you don't boo Kevin Durant when he goes down hurt, but people didn't know that in real time. Anyway, it's similar to that. And there's also like a performance component of it where if I'm a 76ers fan, yeah, I'm irritated that that didn't work out and I want to boo the guy because it's fun.
Yeah.
A small part of me wonders too, though, like, could this have worked if the front office managed this all better and you know, the organization was better equipped to help navigate something like that? That's the part that is curious to me, but no, that has nothing to do with tonight. Tonight, they're going to boo him relentlessly, and he's going to smirk at it.
Well, and the reason I know it's not a straw man is because I saw some of the things that were said when Naomi Osaka talked about this very thing, right? That we're people, that there's too much negativity, and it's weird in an individual sport to boo an athlete. But yeah, it's fine. If like you cheer the other person to boo someone else, like it is, like this isn't, I guess this sounds harsh in many instances, but I truly believe it here. Like, that's what the money's for does apply here, right?
Yeah, and like you said, there's a line I think everyone, you know, intellectually knows where that line is roughly, and what booing Ben Simmons because he's your ex-player and things didn't end well and it's fun to have a night like that. Like, this market knows well what that's like. Like, for years, Vince would get showered with boos when he came back. And that was a very clear, like, that was a similar situation, like cloudy injury stuff, forcing your way out, never reached the heights you kind of expected in that era. And again, same thing. You can play the blame game and figure out who's responsible for that. But it doesn't change the fact that for years, one of the most fun things you could do as a Raptors fan was go to the game and boo Vince Carter. And that had no, like, Vince Carter now has a good relationship with the city for the most part. And like,
yeah,
gets the heroes.
It's not real life.
Yeah. And some stuff with it is, but not booing a guy who was bad on your team and wanted to leave. And is now on a team that, by the way, had both these teams not got off to terrible starts the season. Like, they're supposed to be two of the four best teams in the Eastern Conference. Like, there's a real competitive element to this 100%. Too. Of like, you probably want Ben Simmons to fail because you're afraid of the Nets if things click.
100%. And to Ben Simmons' credit, he's not shied away from it. Like, you mentioned that comment, like, leading up to this thing, knows what's coming and is fine with it.
He's also been a little bit more open than we've ever heard him about his own shortcomings as a player, where like he's pretty, I mean, how could you not own up to how he's played so far? He hasn't been very effective, shooting a high percentage, but like not near the player that he was in Philadelphia. So maybe there's some growth on his side of things too. And I think him having the ability to laugh at the situation and laugh with the 76ers fans heading into this, I think, you know, you hope it shows some growth on his side too.
Yeah, we'll see. He's starting to get better. That Brooklyn Nets team is starting to get better. We'll see how they look against the Raptors tomorrow. Before we get to last call here, we're starting to see some images coming out of Rogers Center. They've started the demolition, the renovation for next season. 17,000 seats from the 500 level were taken out as part of the demolition and renovation. They're going to just be new seats because those were like original from when Sky Dome was built. In what, 89? They're probably going to sell them. I want one. I don't know, 17,000. Like, I figure that's enough that, you know, I'm probably not going more than $500 on one of those, right? Where are you on sports memorabilia? Do you have, like, what is your most prized sports memorabilia collection? Do you do it at all?
I don't have much. I have a pair of signed Jose Calderon sneakers when he had his own, I think it was Li Ning, sneaker. And that was a gift from a reader who was like cleaning out storage and messaged me and was like, I know Jose Calderon was like your favorite player. I have these. Would you like them? And I thought that was a really nice thing to do. And yeah, that's it.
We'll do more of that tomorrow. Last call brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. It is Canada, big time underdogs against Belgium, plus 550, Belgium minus 200. It starts with Morocco and Croatia. Morocco plus 275 to win that opening match of the group tomorrow morning at 5 in the morning. Spain and Costa Rica as well. Spain minus 590 tomorrow. That was Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. All right, Canada, Belgium tomorrow. We'll talk to you after the game. This has been the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.